Lots of culinary schools around the country have restaurants that serve meals to the public. But Shannon Mullen reports on one program in New England where the students aren't just chefs in training, they're also inmates.
The Fife and Drum restaurant is on the outskirts of historic Concord, Massachusetts. It has a school cafeteria feel with linoleum floors and card tables under bright blue plastic tablecloths. And it serves only lunch, but a hot meal made mostly from scratch costs just $3.21.
When I first started coming here, it was $1.42.
Bob Hertz has been having lunch here a few times a week for 20 years.
It's been a fantastic price, and the food's good. Some people are a little nervous about the environment. We had a group of women come from an insurance company. As they walked in, there was a frisk going on. And we saw them once and never saw them again. So it depends on the person.
To get a table at the Fife and Drum, first you have to go through security. The restaurant is inside the Northeast Correctional Center, a minimum security prison.
Gravy looks all set. It's 11:15, so 15 minutes till showtime.
Calvin Hodge is halfway through a six-year sentence. He and his fellow students have been in the kitchen since 7 a.m. prepping today's meal.
Mashed potatoes, the stuffing, vegetables, green beans, and cranberry sauce and gravy on top.
Today, Hodge is head chef, but the inmates rotate jobs every 5 weeks.
It gives me that experience of working in a real restaurant. So when I do go home, I can say I got X amount of time of real experience, hands-on everything, feeding to the public, and I can cook pretty good, so I should be able to get a position somewhere.
Prison officials say their vocational education programs give inmates real skills that they can use to find work when they're released, and that reduces the risk that they'll reoffend. The culinary program spends about $500 a week on food, offset by what customers pay. And the restaurant has a lot of regulars, including Mark Higgins.
It's definitely different being here for lunch, but I enjoy it very much. Of course, we don't want to say how really good it is because the secret will be out.
Well, right now I'm just serving the turkey.
Calvin, you might have to go like a little piece. You know what I mean?
The inmate's instructor, Kim Lukatich, came here from a regular culinary school, and she says there are some unique challenges to running one in a prison. For one thing, the knives are tethered to the tables or locked in cabinets. The inmates have to learn a lot of skills on the job, in addition to waiting tables.
They get to kind of get acclimated to talking to people again, associating with people again. You know, it takes a little getting used to for anybody, customer service. But yeah, these guys are really doing a nice job.
See you again. How are we doing?
Good.
Thanks for coming in today. What can I get you?
Mark Molina is a first-time nonviolent offender serving a three-year sentence. This month, he's waiting tables and baking desserts.
This baking stuff is like a chemistry. You got to get everything just right. You know, if you screw up one thing, it's kind of... It comes out like a brick rather than a cake, you know.
But Molina says the hours go by quickly, and he's grateful for that. His favorite part of the day is when he and his classmates get to sit down and try what they've made.
Oh, man. Great. Calvin, you outdid yourself, buddy. Great.
Came out good.
As for Molina's baking skills, his chocolate cream pie gets an A+. For NPR News, I'm Shannon Mullen.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Many people use artificial sweeteners as a substitute for sugar. Now more are using a substitute for artificial sweeteners. A natural sweetener that's gaining popularity is called stevia.
Excuse me?
That's stevia.
I'm right here.
Steve, the name of the sweetener is stevia.
Ah, yes, please, go ahead.
The powder in little green packets has no calories and a growing number of fans, as NPR's Dan Charles reports.
Those green packets of stevia have been around for a while, but until 4 years ago, American food companies weren't allowed to use it in soft drinks or cakes. Then, in 2008, the Food and Drug Administration said, okay, stevia is safe. Europe followed. And now there's a kind of stevia gold rush underway.
It could be the biggest non-sugar sweetener, and that's really big.
Grover Wickersham is right in the middle of it. I met Wickersham at the Village Pub in Woodside, California. It's a Silicon Valley kind of place, a venture capital hangout. Wickersham has one foot in this big money part of California. He's a deal-making securities lawyer. But the other foot is in the farmland of California's Central Valley. He's the son of a rancher, And now he's chairman of S&W Seed Company, which grows and sells alfalfa seed. When Wickersham heard about stevia, the Silicon Valley side of him said, wow, that's a hot new business, an all-natural sugar substitute. And the farming side said, hey, this comes from a plant.
You grow it in the soil.
Right now, Asian companies dominate the stevia business. The biggest market is in Japan, and Chinese farmers grow most of it by hand. Wickersham thought, maybe we can do better.
Because, you know, California is famous for being able to grow pretty much anything as well or better than any other place in the world. So we may not be able to compete with making all the things that are made in China, but actually one area where California does compete really effectively is agriculture.
Today, Wickersham's company has thousands of little stevia seedlings growing in a cavernous rented greenhouse south of Salinas. Koran Sahota is in charge of the project.
These are all stevia plants. This is just the beginning of our spring planting. We're making more and more plants.
How many do you want to make?
Millions.
A full-grown stevia plant is a leafy bush, about knee-high. There's a man at the greenhouse today who has a longer history with stevia than almost anyone else in the United States, Clint Schock, a researcher at Oregon State University. Schock first saw stevia 40 years ago in Paraguay. Some farmers there were growing it in their gardens.
And they gave me some plants. They also explained where it grew in nature.
So Schock went to the places where stevia grew wild.
And we got a whole truckload of little plants and started a plantation.
That venture flopped. Marketing problems, Schock says. But now he has another chance working with Koran Sahota and his team. They're trying to turn this wild plant into an industrial-scale crop at Silicon Valley speed, figuring out how to plant and harvest it mechanically, trying to breed new varieties of stevia, turning the plant into a better biological sweetness factory.
Ideally, what we would want is very little leaf with 10 times the sweetness. One big plant that's got a lot of sweetness, and we harvest it once.
That harvest, dried leaves that look a little bit like hay, goes to a big stevia processor called Pure Circle. It's up to Pure Circle to extract the sweet compounds from these leaves and make something that tastes just like sugar, which, it turns out, is quite a challenge. Paul Breslin, a psychologist of taste at Rutgers University and also the Monell Center in Philadelphia, says people don't really think about how sugar tastes, how quickly they sense its sweetness and how quickly it fades.
But if you give them something that differs from that, like something that just lingers way too long, they'll notice that immediately and they'll say, it really lingers in my mouth.
Let's do a little taste test with stevia, Breslin says. We rip open two little green packets and mix the sweet powder into cups of hot water. Then we take five sips, one right after the other, to see if each sip tastes the same.
It's one, sweet.
But by the fifth sip, that sweetness somehow disappears. That doesn't happen with sugar, Breslin says, but it does with all the zero-calorie sweeteners, including stevia. Now, the big stevia processor, Pure Circle, says they're working on this. Sid Perkayastha, the company's vice president for global technical development, says the interesting thing is stevia leaves actually contain a whole family of different sweet molecules called stevial glycosides. So you can create different mixtures, tweaking the taste.
What we found that as we bring together different stevial glycosides molecules, they start performing better in many cases, and more like sugar.
Maybe the perfect combination, he says, is a mixture of stevia and regular sugar. You'd have some calories, but a lot fewer. You'd have the sweetness that people crave. And you could still call it all natural. Dan Charles, NPR News.
Well, now on to some slightly warmer waters. Sturgeon have been swimming around for more than 200 million years, but their eggs have long been sought after for caviar, and they've been overfished. This week, the National Marine Fisheries Service placed the Atlantic sturgeon on its endangered species list, and the ruling has implications that go far beyond the caviar industry. Professor Ellen Pickett runs the Institute for Ocean Conservation Science at Stony Brook University, and she's an expert on all things sturgeon, and she joins us from our New York Bureau. Professor, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Give us a sturgeon primer. I mean, where do sturgeon fit in the fish family? What do they look like?
They've been on Earth before the dinosaurs. They kind of look ancient. They have long snouts. Sturgeon are unusual fish in that they have to go up into fresh water, into rivers, to spawn. And along the Atlantic coast, some of the major spawning rivers include the Hudson River, the Delaware River. They spend most of their lives in the ocean. So they're subject to threats, not just in the rivers in which they spawn, but all along the Atlantic coast.
Well, tell us what this ruling means. I mean, as I understand it, Atlantic sturgeon, it's been illegal in the U.S. to fish for them to get caviar for some time. So why this ruling now from the National Marine Fisheries, and what are the implications?
Well, Atlantic sturgeon were overfished more than a century ago, and their numbers are about an order of magnitude lower than they were about 100 years ago. In about 1990, there was a ruling that established a moratorium on fishing for sturgeon, and yet there just hasn't been the kind of comeback that one would hope to see for this fish.
So we go from a restriction on fishing to now endangered species. That takes it up a notch in a way.
It takes it up a big notch because now it's not only fishing activities, it can affect navigation, dredging, it can impact other fisheries that fish for other species. Without any intention to catch sturgeon, other fisheries sometimes incidentally do catch them. Then those fish die.
I know a lot of our listeners who like caviar might wonder what this might mean, even though it's, you know, Atlantic sturgeon, you can't fish for them for the last 20 years. I mean, do you eat caviar? Are you worried about this? Are there other places to get caviar?
You know, in my opinion, there are no wild populations of sturgeon where it would be a good idea to get caviar from. All the species of sturgeon are in trouble. I do eat caviar. I'm one of the caviar lovers. But when I do eat caviar, I choose to eat farm-raised caviar, and only from farms that practice really good environmentally friendly practices.
Professor Ellen Pickich runs the Institute for Ocean Conservation Science at Stony Brook University, and she was speaking to us from our bureau in New York. Thanks very much, Professor.
Thank you very much, David.
This is NPR News.
For many chefs, winning the prize we'll talk about next is like winning the Super Bowl. But in the international contest's 26-year history, no American has ever won the Bocuse d'Or. That's D'OR. The first step in deciding who represents the United States is a national competition, which was recently held at the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, New York. Karen Michelle was there.
The competition was held, fittingly, in the Culinary Institute's gym. The bleachers held cheering fans, the PA system blared, huge overhead screens showed close-ups of the action, and the competitors, intense, focused, brought their coaches.
Do it right now. Put it back up there. Make sure the warmer's on.
There should have been a warning at the door of the Bocuse d'Or. Don't try this at home, unless, along with the wonder flower used by one chef, you also have powders of squash and hibiscus, truffles both black and white, and fennel pollen, yes, pollen, in your kitchen pantry. Each of the four chefs was charged with making two dishes of their own invention, one entree of cod and one of chicken.
The most difficult thing in cooking is to cook an egg. So if the eggs is the most difficult thing, imagine the chicken.
Chef Daniel Boulou, whose New York City restaurant Daniel has been named one of the 10 best restaurants in the world, was one of the judges. We watched as Jeffrey Lizotte, his hands slightly shaking, prepared his chicken dish.
He has a chicken ballotine with foie gras and black truffle, carotte royale with pistachio, celery root millefeuille, and a sauce perigordine. He has a lot of work to do.
No mistake, it was work. Each of the four kitchens buzzed with chopping, stirring, arranging, and tension. This is competition cooking, and the chefs train as intensely as any athlete.
Because it's a 5.5-hour marathon of food.
Danny Cercada has a close-trimmed beard and a big smile. It was his second time competing in the Bocuse d'Or USA. Born in Georgia, now he cooks in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Wrap the chicken in bacon and sausage. And I love bacon, and I love wrapping anything in bacon because bacon makes everything taste better.
800 or so enthusiastic spectators watched the chefs as closely as any football fan waiting for a slick move. Some fans of cooking shows on TV, and others like Peter Haynes, hoping to someday be one of the contestants.
I love sports, so competing is natural to me. I think it kind of goes hand in hand with cooking a little bit.
Haynes hopes to be hired by one of the competitors, fresh-faced Richard Rosendale, an executive chef in White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia. He seemed positively calm.
Well, I try to use some ingredients that are indigenous to the style of cooking in West Virginia. We use some country ham, cornbread, some West Virginia maple syrup.
In 2008, Richard Rosendale came in second in the U.S. final for the Bocuse d'Or competition. This time, he was considered a favorite to win. At a predetermined time, as each chef finished his dish, it was brought out to the 12 seated judges, themselves distinguished chefs, first the cod, then the chicken. The judges picked at the food, assessing the taste and texture, the look, the relative deliciousness of the meal, filling out a detailed score sheet between bites and sips of champagne.
This is a leek. A whole stuff leek. Beautiful.
Yeah, that's nice.
There was pressure to pick a winner who could not only represent the United States at the competition a year from now in Lyon, but finally win. No U.S. chef has come closer than a sixth-place finish. In the end, the winner was the chef with the most fans in the stands and the biggest buzz among the epicures.
Okay, without further ado, I'm really proud to announce the winner and the next team for the United States of America, Richard Rosendale.
For NPR News, I'm Karen Michelle.